Welcome back to Hour 2 of the Hollywood Casino Press Box, featuring Frank Cusimano and Martin Kilcoyne on 590 The Fan and 590thefan.com.
Welcome back. Sinewy Martin Kilcoyne coming off a heavy ab workout this morning.
I've been accused of my outfit. It said you look like you're taking the kids to the zoo. And then it said, it looks like you're chaperoning one of the kids' field trips. I'm basically just in casual sports gear. Went for a nice walk with Kim this morning, but I want to do a little more of a workout this afternoon. So I took a shower, but I put on sporting gear, Frank. Don't I look like the coach? Recess? Get these kids going?
Yeah, I could see that.
Maybe we should put it online and get some votes. What does Martin look like he's dressed for today? But nonetheless,
let's head to Busch Stadium and check in with Bill DeWitt III, who's got a big event coming up. Bill, good to be with you. How are you, sir?
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Very good. So we're excited about this movie on tomorrow night.
Tomorrow night, yeah.
At the Chase Breakthrough, which is one of the most amazing stories with a St. Louis angle. Tell our listening audience about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredible story. This young man was 14 years old, and he was basically drowned. He died or was, clinically pronounced dead and for about an hour and ended up coming back through. And it's the story of sort of what happened, what he experienced, and, very kind of faith-based messaging based on what this young man experienced. It's really cool. I haven't actually seen the movie. I've just heard about the story and really looking forward to meeting the young man tomorrow night at the event.
Yeah, and he's going to be there. It's at the Chase Park Plaza Wednesday night. It's the premiere for the movie Breakthrough. You can get tickets at stlewiscinema.com, stlewiscinema.com. It's only $10.50 to go, and again, the family members are going to be there. Bill and his wife, Ira, are going to be there. And I'm wondering, Bill, how you got associated with this. I mean, I guess it's such a cool story, it's hard not to be attached to it or drawn to it.
Yeah, there was kind of a St. Louis angle, but really how we got involved is Ira has this candle business, which is called St. Candles, and they're a bunch of they're sort of modern, cool-looking candles that each have a patron saint associated with them. And, there's a prayer coin in the bottom of the candle that when it burns down. And anyway, the long story short is she did a partnership with the movie premiere and the movie itself because of the faith-based nature of the movie. And, of course, Ira's proceeds go to St. Jude's, which is a cancer children's center in Memphis. But so there's a lot of fun ties to this. And, we're part of the sort of making the premiere happen tomorrow night.
And the boy is actually going to be there, correct, John Smith?
Yes, he'll be there. And Martin's emceeing. And I'll just say hi to everybody. And he's going to come up. And I guess, Martin, you're going to have the duties to interview him and, have him speak to the group.
I'm wondering, too, and I guess we'll ask him tomorrow if the family has seen the film, because a lot of times, in Hollywood, it's, they just exaggerated. This story is a little hard to exaggerate. I mean, the fact it really happened almost seems like a Hollywood script.
Yeah, and that's why I think tomorrow is such a fun thing, because you'll actually get to meet him and, put the face with the name and the story. And, I would imagine people that are inspired by this will want to grab him after. Tell me exactly how you felt. I want to know, any proof of the divine. People sort of, it's a very impactful thing.
And hopefully people will join us tomorrow night, stlewiscinema.com. It's only $10.50 to go to the premiere of the movie Breakthrough, and it's going to be at the Chase Park Plaza, which is also just a great place to hang out.
Absolutely. It'll be a fun event. I'm really looking forward to it. A little bit of, I don't know if you want to talk too much baseball in this group, but we could probably talk about the bullpen or whatever, or just stick to candles and movies.
Yeah, maybe we could light a candle for the bullpen, Bill.
Yes.
Is that too soon? Is that too soon?
That's a good segue. You guys are good.
Thank you.
Maybe more for the starting staff.
Patron
saint
of the rotation.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. What's your level of concern, Bill, with the pitching?
Well, I just think it's been inconsistent, the bullpen. I mean, we've seen flashes of what guys can do. Gant's been a great story. It's interesting the way the bullpens are today. You kind of need that guy that can come in if the starter can't make the third pass through the rotation or through the order to come in and pitch two innings, maybe three. And, we're seeing that emerge in a guy like Gant. And, you know, sometimes you need two of those guys. So that used to be your mop-up guy, you know, that was sort of in case of something. Now it's like a key thing. So things are evolving. Things are changing. I think Miller will be fine. But, you know, it's early, and there have been a little bit of hiccups, but I think we'll be okay.
You know, there is an interesting starting pitcher out there who's a free agent named Dallas Keuchel. Do you think your organization would start to kick the tires or even discuss that?
You know, I don't know. We're always looking at everything. At this point, I think we're happy with the club. We really want to see how it evolves based on the group we have. But, you know, you're always looking, seeing what's out there. I mean, obviously, that's an unusual situation. We're not sure what he's doing to stay in shape or to get game simulations or whatever. But I think right now we're good where we are.
Bill, how do you handle the highs and lows? And how much do you monitor? The fans tend to overreact. I think that's fair in 2019. I mean, a week ago, we probably could have traded Marcelo Ozuna based on fan reaction for a bag of balls. And now he's one of your best hitters. And it is sort of the long game, and I know Mo always talks about that. But how do you get a kick out of it? Do you monitor it, or how do you ride those highs and lows?
Well, it's hard because you are, you know, so invested in it, and you know, mentally, psychologically, emotionally, financially, in our case. And I think of the fans as financially invested too. Obviously, they pay for the tickets, but you know, it's hard. But I think over the years, I've learned to sort of keep an even keel. The one thing I notice about myself, and I don't know if this is true of you guys or of fans, is that I'm sort of more annoyed and mad at a loss than I am happy for a win. I'm trying to get, you know, that switched around, you know, where it's like, you know, and you got to enjoy it when they're doing well. And it's this sort of, you know, you dwell on the one missed putt, even though you made 10 great putts on the putt, you know, on the green. So it's that same mentality that I'm trying to, like, even after, you know, however many years, it's been 24, that you still try to work on so that you can enjoy the season a little more.
How about a quick thought on Ballpark Village? What percentage do you have committed? And then can you give us an idea on the people that are buying, or it's all buying, it's not renting, correct?
No, it's all rental. On the apartment tower, yeah.
Yeah. Well, do you know if the higher percentage of them will live there full time, or are some looking at it as more of a summer thing when the Cardinals are playing?
You know, we haven't broken that down yet. We are 30% pre-leased. There are 300 units. We will, you know, we're more than a year out with that one. The other stuff's coming sooner, but that tower, because it's so tall, takes longer. It will coming online around May, June. But most apartment towers don't start leasing until they're a year out. And so we're ahead of that by even having even more than a year out and 30%, which is great. How that breaks out, I think there are probably some people that would normally come to town four or five times a year from an outer market like a Cape Girardeau or a Springfield or something and rent those. But there's also a good chunk who are just, you know, young professionals or millennials or whatever who are that want to live downtown. And that's what I'm really excited about, because the whole point of phase two is to generate those activities that create foot traffic and a sense of community and the village, really. And that's why we have office, we have residential, we have a health club, we've got a hotel, and of course, everybody knows about the retail and the first phase, and more of that coming too.
And Bill, anytime we talk about downtown, there's a concern. Well, I don't want to go down there. I don't want to live there. And Frank and I have talked about it. When you guys launched this, I said there had to have been some market research. You had to, I mean, how much of it was a leap of faith, and the Cardinal brand is strong, but how much of it, too, did you say there's a need for this, or people will, I mean, how do you know when you go into this?
Well, our development partner, Cordish Company, has done a lot of development around the country, and a lot of times in similar size markets. For example, in Kansas City, they've built two big towers like this, residential towers, and they're under construction on a third, as well as some other markets. We looked at other things and other trends, and there's definitely a wave of people interested in that urban experience, and, you know, we just feel confident that there will be enough of them that we'll fill this tower and hopefully one or two more. I mean, when you go up there, I was up there the other day, and you go up to the top of the garage, which is already built, and then there's a couple floors of the residence already built right now. But when you go to the top of the garage, which is the amenity deck, and you see where there's going to be an infinity pool with the backdrop of Busch Stadium, and you can actually see into the ballpark, and you know that there'll be a coffee bar and a barbecue pit and a fire pit and just a hangout area, office spaces to break out, and that's just for the residents. You get the feeling that this is going to be special. And you go up in the units and you see the arch and the river and the ballpark. There's nothing like this. I think just the pure excitement of that will bring enough people to fill it. That's our thesis anyway.
Good stuff, Bill. We appreciate your time. We'll see you tomorrow night at the Chase Park Plaza.
All right, thanks. Thanks, guys. Take care.
Yeah,
all
and
right.
You get those tickets, stlewiscinema.com, for the premiere of Breakthrough, Chase Park Plaza. And again, the kid is going to be there that fell through the ice. It's weird because when this story came out, I read a little bit about it, then they launched the movie. I don't remember it as a news event. Do you? It's crazy. It was January of 2015, and I barely remember it as a story. Also, those candles that Bill was talking about that his wife Ira makes, you can get information on those at saintcandles.net. Saintcandles.net.
I'm surprised that Hollywood actually allowed for this movie to be made, because I don't think they believed in God in Hollywood. So
yeah, it's a Disney-related release. I'm not sure what branch it is.
All right, let's welcome to the program the fine former writer with the Post-Dispatch and now an author of many books, and the newest one is just insane. We just picked it up. It's called Celebration, The Magic of the Cardinals in the 1980s, Dan O'Neill. And Dan, these pictures are absolutely just unbelievable. Where did you have access?
Yeah.
How did you
well,
find
that's,
this?
You know, that's the challenge of the book, doing books like that. You know, it's a coffee table book and lots of pictures. And the goal is to find pictures people haven't seen over and over again over the years through the Post-Dispatch. So a lot of the pictures are from Getty Images, which is a sort of a wire service, if you will, of photography. But a lot of pictures people haven't seen before. Some of them are just from personal collections and things like that. And they're pretty spectacular, Frank, if I do say so myself. I am a faith-based author, by the way.
Faith-based good author.
Every
Dan
time
O'Neill.
I do a book, there's a leap of faith involved.
For you and the publisher.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what's interesting is people are reading on the Kindles, they're reading on their phones, but you can't replicate the coffee table books or pictures in front of you. So to me, there's always going to be a need for these larger books that you can hold and flip through and see the photos. It's one thing to read the romance novel on the beach on your Kindle, but I think this is not going to go away, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think that's Reedy Publishing would agree with you. I mean, the other books are really hard to sell unless you're John Grisham or somebody like that. But these books, you know, that book, like the Blues book I did recently, is a book you have on your table. You can pick it up. You can read a couple of episodes, put it back down, and it's just something you can revisit all the time.
And your journalism is all over this book, including a great story about Ted Simmons's first base hit off Claude Osteen and the conversation with the first baseman.
Yeah, that's right. That's a great story. You know, one of the highlights of the book is I got a hold of a lot of the players and managers, coaches from the 1980s and what I tried to do is get a little anecdote story from them, not necessarily tied to an event that involved them, but just something they would tell somebody about the 1980s. And I asked Ted Simmons for one, and he gave me a story about Ken Boyer, who he played for in the late 70s and in 1980. And Ted got his first hit in the big leagues. And when he got to first base, Ken Boyer was the first baseman for the Dodgers. And he said, is that your first hit, Rook? And Ted said, yeah. And he said, well, I hope you have 2,500 more of them.
And Simmons had 2,472.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. But he thought beautiful. The world of that's one of the interesting things in doing the book, Frank and Martin, is the stories that I got and finding out how much respect some of these guys had for certain guys that you didn't necessarily realize that before. And Ken Boyer was one of those guys.
And so it's a collection of stories, right? Is that
it's
how,
a collection
how would you describe it?
I would describe it as it's a collection of pictures and episodes. The biggest, the highlights of the 1980s. I mean, you're talking about a decade. So I tried to grab what I thought were the biggest headline stories of the 80s and then pictures to go with them. And then a short story or memory from some of the players that were involved.
Okay, the John Stuper story, pitching in Dodger Stadium with Fernando Valenzuela and Stuper really struggling. Pick it up.
Yeah, that's great. I'm glad you're asking me about all these, Frank, because it's been a while since I did.
We're jogging your memory here.
Yeah. Well, I you know, I called Stuper and I thought he'd give me a story about the World Series game that he pitched, but he instead told me about his first or that big start. It was in Los Angeles, and it was against, as you said, Fernando Valenzuela. Big high profile game, and he went out and he couldn't throw the ball over the plate. I think he walked the first three or four batters, and Whitey came out and got him. And when he got to the dugout,
oh, you want me to read it?
Right? Yeah, you read it.
This is so good. He says, I sit down on the bench, and after about 5 minutes, Bob Forsch, one of my mentors, sits down beside me. I'm still obviously pissed. Forsch looks at me and says, Stoop, I can't believe Whitey took you out. You had a no-hitter going.
Well, you know, Forsch was one of those guys, like I was saying about Ken Boyer. I talked to so many guys who gave me a Forsch story. You know, I didn't use them all because you didn't want to overdo it, but he was a guy who I don't think I certainly didn't appreciate it as much, who was an absolute riot and a guy everybody looked up to in the Cardinal dugout.
I think what's amazing with the Cardinal old-timers also over the years, from Red and now to Whitey, no matter what their age is, the memory they have of the specific moments, you know, yeah. And we joked about it. Frank and I would be on this Red Ribbon panel, and Red Shanians would roll off the top of his head something that happened in 1939 or 40, and you say, Red, where'd you park your car? Well, I have no idea.
Yeah.
But this
yeah.
stuff from 50, 60 years ago, they've had an incredible resource. I think when you do anything Cardinals, these guys have this incredible memory.
Yeah, you know, just it's funny how people are like that. You know, like Arnold Palmer and Jack Nicklaus were like that, and Nicklaus still is. I mean, you can bring up a tournament he played in and a championship he won and ask him what club he used on 7th hole, and he'll tell you. It's unbelievable, those guys. Scotty Bowman's like that, too. He can talk about those things from long, long ago with and articulate them so specifically. And a lot of these guys are like that. And as Frank pointed out, I mean, some of the stories in there are priceless. It's just great stuff.
Well, Andy Van Slyke in his first week in the big leagues facing Tom Seaver. He actually had a Tom Seaver poster in his room, and he homers off Tom Seaver. And he says, I don't remember touching the ground as I ran around the bases. I only remember touching the bases. I slammed my foot on home plate, and in my mind, that poster tore itself in half. It was like, oh, my God, did that just happen?
Yeah.
God, you got some unbelievable quotes here.
Yeah, well, Vance, like, as you guys know, I mean, you've talked to Vance, like, he gave me a couple of great stories. I didn't use them all, but one great Van Slyke comment that I didn't use, I just thought I wouldn't, but he told me, you know, and Van Slyke won 7 gold gloves, I think, and he was early in his career here with St. Louis, went on to much bigger things, but he told me that throw he made in Game 6 of the 85 World Series is the greatest throw he made in his career. And if you remember, people never talked about it, but Sundberg should have been out at the plate. Van Slyke fielded Orge's base hit, charged it, threw an absolute laser strike to home plate on the fly, not short hop or anything, on the fly. But for some reason, Daryl Porter took a step up to come and get it and then had to try to reach back behind him to tag Sundberg, who slid across the plate. He was safe. And Van Slyke's comment was, if we'd have had the chemically imbalanced Daryl Porter, he'd have been out at the plate.
And in a game that's been digested and dissected for years, I don't know if I've ever heard anybody talk about the throw.
Yeah.
And like how
that's the first thing I asked.
Right.
Him.
I mean, that's part of that game. We focus on Dankinger and everything else and the drop ball and Clark, but I've heard very few people actually think about that aspect.
I actually blame Porter. You know, God bless him, but he had two plays in that inning that were crucial, just as big as the call at first base. I mean, you have to remember, Orta didn't even score in that inning. I mean, they got Orta out at third base. They tried to sacrifice. Todd Worrell made a great play, came off the mound. They got the lead runner at third base. So now they got first and second. and one out. And then Daryl Porter misses a Worrell slider. I guess he thought it was going to be a fastball or whatever. Pass ball, the runners move up. Now they got the winning run on second base. Then Orge got the base hit, and Van Slyke threw a strike to the plate, and they didn't get the runner. So,
and then, you know, just the intimate details about what went on behind closed doors, why Bruce Sutter left St. Louis. He got the offer from Atlanta, and he goes into Whitey's office, and he says to Whitey, if you give me 12 no-trade teams that I can't be traded to, I'll stay in St. Louis. So Herzog tells Fred Kuhlman and Maxey, I can give you 12 teams that don't need him and don't want him or can't afford him, and he's going to let me do it. Yeah. But they came back and they said, they're not going to let me do it because August said he's not a 10-5-year guy.
Yeah.
He has to earn that before he gets no trade, and that's how he lost Sutter. Now, it didn't turn out to be all that horrible because Bruce had some arm issues after that, but still.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Sutter was out of the game by 1988, and he hardly pitched for Atlanta. So it's sort of like the Albert Pujols thing, you know, it actually worked out pretty well. But
yeah,
it's a great story because Whitey said he could have named 12 teams off the top of his head that, A, couldn't afford Sutter, and B, didn't want him.
That's such a Whitey quote, you know, and that's how his brain works. Yeah. He can, like, immediately give you that, and it has a slightly cutting edge to it,
so
but it's
different.
Factual.
So, I mean, you guys were around, I mean. The quotes you would get from the managers back then, you know, from Whitey and Joe Torre, too, and compared to today, it's just, man.
Like the direct nature of it in the past, you know.
Yeah, I mean,
but he can't hit a lick, and now he's really battling.
Everybody wants to protect their players. It's not like they would come out and rip guys, necessarily, but they would be a little bit more genuine about it, you know.
So did you spend a lot of time with Whitey in this?
Yeah, I went and had – well, of course, I see Whitey all the time because I'm in the 1-2-3 club.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, you were just talking to one of my fellow members. But so I see Whitey all the time, and I played in his golf tournament. So, but we went out, and I spent about 4 hours with Whitey. We had lunch and kind of went over the entire decade and, you know, some of the things that I knew I was going to address in the book. I did that with Dale Maxfield, too, went out and had a long session with Dale Maxfield and, to get some background, not necessarily because I was quoting them or anything. I just wanted to hear about these things from them and try to get a little insight.
What's his relationship with the franchise? Now, that's a name you never hear, you never see much about, right?
I mean, that, Dale
with Maxfield, yeah, over the years.
Well, he was a GM.
But I'm saying you just don't see him, his name
exactly,
associated
ever.
Anymore.
Well, I see what you're saying.
I'm just saying that's a name.
Yeah, you know, it's funny.
That was a pretty big Cardinal name. Then all of a sudden,
he's not interested. You know, I really like Dale a lot, and I have a ton of respect for him. I mean, he's very much a man's man. I mean, he's not interested in living in the past, and that part of his life's over, and he's just not interested in coming down to Busch Stadium and having people cheer for him and stuff like that. It's just not who he is. You know, Bill White's the same way. I mean,
declined.
Yeah,
the Hall of Fame.
I personally think Maxfield should be in the Cardinal Hall of Fame. You're talking about a guy who played on two world championship teams, three World Series, was a coach here, was a general manager for two World Series teams. All the things he did in baseball, he should definitely be in the Cardinals Hall of Fame, but there's no way he would be interested.
Yeah, it's interesting because you have another Herzog quote here. He's talking about Tommy Herr, and he says Tommy Herr should definitely be in the Cardinals Hall of Fame, which I think we may make that happen one day. But he's got this great story here. He says to Tommy Herr, you're the only guy who can hit three. He says, Tommy, you're the only guy I've got who can hit third. I told him, you're at the plate. The count's 2-0. You've got Jack Clark on deck. What are they going to throw you? You got 3-1. What are they going to throw you? He said, fastball? I said, damn right.
Yeah. Herr was a great – if you remember that season, he had 110 RBIs with just 8 home runs, which is just unbelievable. But, you know, baseball was – the beauty of the 80s was it was real baseball. I mean, the ball was in play. You know, you had the reason the Cardinals were successful is they could catch it, they could run the bases, they could throw it, they could do everything better than those three things better than everybody else. I mean, you know, their teams, during that decade, the Cardinal teams averaged 860 strikeouts a season. Six times they were under 900 strikeouts during the decade. Well, last year they struck out 1,380 times. And this year they're on pace to strike out 1,500 times. I mean, you know, today's baseball is basic. The ball's never in play. You either hit a home run, you walk, or you strike out.
Now, that said, does Marcelo Zuna remind you at all of Lonnie Smith? Is there that spirit of adventure when we have a fly ball to left? Is that unfair to Lonnie?
Well, defensively, yeah.
That's what I'm saying. Defensively, is there reminders?
I never saw Lonnie Smith do a cliff diving thing on
the
left field wall. But, yeah, it's an interesting comparison. But, actually, he's not the only outfielder they have who you could compare to Lonnie Smith. I mean, they've got Jose Martinez and Dexter Fowler running around out there, too. So,
all right, is this book at bookstores now?
Yeah, it should be at bookstores this week. It just got into town late last week. So it should be at Barnes & Noble and Novel Neighbor and Neighborhood Reads and the local
bookstores. How about online, or is it a better thing to buy them at the bookstore?
Well, if you're going to buy it online, I'd prefer you bought it from readypress.com. You can order it there, but it's certainly available online.
Greg Vitello, the outstanding coach, tell Dan that Kramer called, wanted to know if the book would fit on his coffee table. And then he says he's waiting for the Cubs edition of this book.
By the way, Dan O'Neill is here, and we're not talking Masters or Blues.
Isn't that shocking? I'm a little surprised, yeah.
We're in the wake of Tiger and an epic win at the Masters, and Dan went to Augusta for many years.
But see, I'm like Jose Oquendo, you know, like.
You're the
baseball,
secret weapon here?
Hockey.
How many years did you go to Augusta?
18.
18 years.
Yeah.
At Augusta. What was the greatest championship you covered? Which year
the first
was
Tiger, right?
I was there for 97, yeah. You know, that was spectacular without a doubt.
I always thought
the Ben Crenshaw one was really special because it was so out of left field. And then, of course, I was there for Norman's collapse, too.
Oh, you had to bring that up.
Frank's favorite. Really
crazy. Yeah, but, you know, I'll just say this. You know, people are getting just a little bit carried away with the Tiger thing. I mean, it's a great story, phenomenal comeback. Nobody saw it coming. Although I would argue that when he won the Tour Championship last fall, it suggested he was capable of winning a major. I mean, that's just like a major. But, you know, you have to remember, Ben Hogan almost got killed in a car accident in 1949 and then won the U.S. Open
11 months later.
Yeah.
Do you think 5 years from now he'll have 18 majors?
I don't know. I mean, at this point, it's how could you say, you know, he won't do that? I wouldn't expect him to do it. I still think Augusta is a place where he can win, and it's going to be a little bit harder for him to win a U.S. Open or a British Open or something like that. But who knows? I mean, he certainly can win it. You know, Tiger's won in his career. There's a handful of golf courses where he's won multiple times. I mean, he won at Torrey Pines 7 or 8 times, and now he's won at Augusta 5 times. So he'll always be a threat there as long as he's healthy. I think that was always the big thing, is would he stay healthy? And that's still a big thing. I mean, when you're talking about somebody's back and, you know, you make a wrong swing and who knows.
You think it's notable that the other players seem genuinely happy for him? And I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, if they cared at all, if Tiger, they probably didn't want him to win. He seems more popular, not just, and I think he has changed, been humbled. We saw a little bit of that at Belle Reve where he was very likable. But it seems like the tour players all like him now. And that was not the case.
Yeah. Yeah, that, you know, that I think a lot of people saw that and wondered about that. And the thing is, I don't think anybody, and none of us really know what kind of person Tiger Woods is.
Yeah.
We just don't. I mean, that's the way his whole career's been like that. He just doesn't let you in. And he appears in press conferences to be, as you said, the edge is off a little bit more human, a little bit more able to smile and enjoy. And he certainly, to me, on the 18th green there, the expressions I saw was probably the most joyful moment he's had.
Well, you think that's, you know, I know Hale Irwin did that high five after he won one of his Opens, but I don't know if I've ever seen a more animated golf championship ever.
Than the Masters?
Yeah, than what we just saw.
Yeah. Well, it was a great finish, it's a great story. I don't think it was the greatest Sunday at the Masters in terms of the play. I mean, Scheffler was tied for the lead with five or six holes to go and just parred. Nobody was, in other words, there were no fireworks.
Well, and Molinari collapsed, and Koepka missed a big putt. Right, there were a lot of people who kind of faded.
And which is kind of the way Tigers won those things. But that's how you win.
Yeah.
But, you know, we've had Masters with much more dynamic shots and episodes than that.
In true Dan O'Neill fashion, on the back of the book, in his description, born in St. Louis, Dan O'Neill graduated from the same University City High School as Tennessee Williams, Bing Devine, and Nelly.
Often compared with all three of those guys.
All right, Dan, this is spectacular stuff. We really appreciate it. Thank you so much for coming in. And you can buy the book all over St. Louis today. Celebration, the magic of the Cardinals in the 1980s.
And Frank, I do want to plug, I'll be at Cliff Cave Library tomorrow night at 7 o'clock.
Where's that, Cliff?
That's in South County on Telegraph Road, and I'll be doing a presentation of the book, which includes video and audio and a whole big show. So
very nice. Dan, we appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
All right, we'll take a short time out. Dr. Rick, when we come back.